This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel like
the last time that Jan and I were here at All Souls was during our honeymoon that we spent in London, and we came here on a Sunday morning to hear John Stott preach. And so it's sort of a romantic return for us to be back in this beautiful church and to have this evening together with you. But tonight we want to consider the evidence for Christianity. The great atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell was once asked what he would say if he found himself standing before God on the judgment day, and God were to say to him, "Russell, why didn't you believe in me?" Russell replied, "I would say, not enough evidence, God, not enough evidence." Well, as I travel around the United States and Europe speaking on university campuses, I think that most of the non-Christian university professors that I meet would say pretty much the same thing. And this attitude is in turn conveyed to their students. And I expect in an audience of this size tonight, there's probably folks here this evening who are thinking the same things quietly in their minds. There's not enough evidence. But I want you to think with me a little bit about that this evening. What do people mean when they say, not enough evidence? Not enough for what? Not enough to be coercive? Not enough to compel someone to believe in Christ? Well, I think a lot of people take it that way. In my experience, most folks tend to be spiritually apathetic. They're either too busy or too unconcerned to be bothered about looking into spiritual things. Or, if they are into spirituality, they're pursuing gods of their own making. But basically, most folks just can't be bothered to look into the evidence for Christianity. And this is particularly true for university professors. One of the most interesting aspects of the work I do is the debates that I participate in on university campuses. Typically, I'll be invited onto a campus where a local professor has a reputation for being especially abusive to Christian students in his classes, holding them up as objects of ridicule and denouncing the Christian faith. And we'll challenge him to a public debate on a topic like, does God exist? Or atheism versus Christianity? Or who was Jesus of Nazareth? And you know what I find? I find that while most of these fellows are pretty good at beating up intellectually on an 18-year-old in one of their classes, they can't even hold their own when it comes to going toe-to-toe with one of their peers. In their opening speech, if you're lucky, they may trot out the obsolete 18th century objections of David Hume and Immanuel Kant, and then after I answer those, they're pretty much left with nothing more to say. And so they either just start repeating themselves or making emotional appeals to win the students to their side. They're especially ignorant of the Gospels. I think that most of them have never even cracked a New Testament, much less studied it. Most of them turn out to be just big, inflated, intellectual blowhards who have no good reason for rejecting Christianity or for ridiculing the Christian students in their classes. Now, in one sense, this isn't really surprising, because you see, all of us in academia have to specialize in a certain field of expertise. And as a result, we're ignorant of things that lie outside our area of specialization. So, for example, I know something about philosophy, but I know absolutely nothing about chemical engineering or agriculture or business or whatever. And thus, you see, it's possible to have a perfectly profound knowledge of your narrow area of specialization and yet have little better than a Sunday school acquaintance with Christianity. For example, I had a debate a few years ago at a major American state university with a philosopher on agnosticism versus Christianity. Now, this man was a brilliant philosopher of quantum physics, the director of the graduate program in philosophy at the university. And yet, the first words out of his mouth when he got up to speak in the debate were these: "I don't really feel qualified to be speaking in tonight's debate because I don't know anything about philosophy of religion." And I thought to myself, well, then why in the world are you getting up in front of 800 students trying to convince them to become agnostics when you admit you don't know anything about the topic? I mean, it doesn't compute. When you read the biographies of the world's great atheists, what you discover is that most of these men lost their faith when they were around 11 or 12 years of age, and they've never studied it again since. Now, think of what that implies. That means that most of them reject Christianity based on the objections of a 12-year-old. So, when people say, there's not enough evidence, what they really mean is, there's not enough evidence to coerce me out of my indifference and make me believe. If I choose to ignore it, the evidence isn't going to grab me by the lapels and make me believe in Christianity. To which I say, well, of course the evidence isn't coercive in that way. But why should it be? You see, the knowledge of God is unique in that the knowledge of God is conditioned by moral and spiritual factors. A spiritually indifferent person can have a perfectly profound knowledge of history or Russian literature or physics or mathematics or even theology, but a spiritually indifferent person cannot know God. The Bible promises the knowledge of God to those who honestly seek Him. And so, for example, the prophet Jeremiah said, "You shall seek me and you shall find me if you seek for me with all your heart." And Jesus said, "Seek and you will find. Knock and the door shall be opened. Ask and it shall be given you. For he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks it shall be opened. And to him who asks it shall be given." In other words, God doesn't force himself upon us. He's given evidence of himself which is sufficiently clear for those with an open mind and an open heart, but which is sufficiently vague so as not to compel people whose hearts are closed. The great mathematical genius Blaise Pascal, who came to know God through a dramatic experience of Jesus Christ at the age of 31, put it in the following way. Pascal wrote, "Willing to appear openly to those who seek him with all their heart, and to be hidden from those who flee from him with all their heart, God so regulates the knowledge of himself that he has given indications of himself which are visible to those who seek him and not to those who do not seek him. There is enough light for those to see who only desire to see, and enough obscurity for those who have a contrary disposition." In other words, the evidence is there for those who have eyes to see. So, admittedly, there's not enough evidence to be coercive. But that's not the really interesting question, is it? The really interesting question is there enough evidence for faith to be rational? And the answer to that question is yes, of course, there is certainly sufficient argument and evidence for faith to be rational. The traditional arguments for the existence of God and the evidences of Christianity may not be coercive, but they are certainly sufficient to ground faith rationally if you're simply willing to look at them with an open mind and an open heart. Take, for example, the question of the existence of God. There has been literally a revolution over the past half century with regard to this question among Anglo-American philosophers. Back in the 1930s and 40s, it was widely believed among philosophers that talk about God was meaningless that it was literal gibberish to say God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life is as meaningless as saying 'twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. Just meaningless nonsense. This movement reached its crescendo in the mid-1960s with the so-called death of God theology. On April 8, 1966, Time magazine carried a dramatic cover story for which the cover was completely black except for three words emblazoned in bright red letters against the dark background. And the words read, "Is God dead?" And it described the movement among theologians to proclaim the death of God. Well, to paraphrase Mark Twain, it seems that the news of God's death was premature. For at the same time that the theologians were writing God's obituary, a new generation of young philosophers was rediscovering his vitality. During the 70s, interest in philosophy of religion began to grow. And just a few years after its death of God issue, Time carried another red-on-black cover story. Only this time, the question read, "Is God coming back to life?" And that's certainly how it must have seemed to those theological morticians of the 1960s. By 1980, Time ran another major story entitled "Modernizing the Case for God," in which it described the movement among contemporary philosophers to refurbish and redefend all of the traditional arguments for God's existence. Time marveled, and I quote, "In a quiet revolution in thought and argument that hardly anybody could have foreseen only two decades ago, God is making a comeback. Most intriguingly, this is happening not among theologians or ordinary believers, but in the crisp intellectual circles of academic philosophers, where the consensus had long banished the Almighty from fruitful discourse." According to the article, the noted American philosopher Roderick Chisholm believed that the reason that atheism was so influential a generation ago is because the brightest philosophers at that time were atheists. But today, he says, the brightest philosophers include theists, that is to say, people who believe in the existence of God, and he says they are using a kind of tough-minded intellectualism in defense of that belief that was formerly lacking on their side of the debate. In the year 2001, in the secularist journal Philo, there was a major article by a noted American atheist philosopher lamenting the desecularization that had occurred in philosophy departments since the late 1960s. He concluded his article, "God is not dead in academia. He is alive and well in his last academic stronghold, philosophy departments." So I'm pleased to say to you this evening that some of England and America's finest philosophers at our most prestigious universities are Bible-believing, outspoken Christians. I think, for example, of Robert Adams and Brian Leftow at Oxford University, George Mavrides at the University of Western Michigan, Dean Zimmerman at Rutgers University, Bill Wainwright at the University of Wisconsin, Eleanor Stump at St. Louis University, Alvin Plantingen, Peter Van Inwagen at the University of Notre Dame, Dallas Willard at USC. I could go on and on. The idea that Christians are intellectual losers and nincompoops is an idea that is simply rooted in ignorance and needs to be once and for all decisively put behind us. Now, my own work as a philosopher has focused upon the implications of modern cosmology for the existence of God. I believe that as contemporary physics probes the natural world, it encounters, as it were, signposts of transcendence, pointing beyond the natural world to its ground in a supernatural creator and designer of the universe. For example, the evidence from the expansion of the universe points to the creation of the universe out of nothing. Most lay people, I find, do not understand that according to the traditional Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe. Not only all matter and energy, but physical space and time themselves come into being at the moment of the Big Bang. Therefore, in the words of the physicist P.C.W. Davies, the Big Bang represents the creation event, the creation not only of all the matter and energy in the universe, but also of space-time itself. But then the question inevitably arises, how can the universe come into being out of nothing? Now notice that this is a philosophical, not a scientific question. Out of nothing, nothing comes. The atheist philosopher Kai Nielsen gives the following illustration. Nielsen says, suppose you suddenly hear a loud bang, and you ask me, what made that bang? And I reply, nothing. It just happened. He says, you wouldn't accept that. In fact, you would find my reply quite unintelligible. Well, what's true of the little bang is also true of the Big Bang as well. It must have had a cause. And from the very nature of the case, as the cause of space and time, it must have been an uncaused, immaterial, changeless, timeless, and enormously powerful being that created the universe. Moreover, and here we come to that second signpost that I wanted to mention, the evidence for the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life points to this cause's being a personal, intelligent mind. During the last 40 years or so, scientists have been stunned by the discovery that the initial conditions given in the Big Bang were fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life with a delicacy and precision that is literally incalculable and incomprehensible. For example, P.C.W. Davies has calculated that the odds against the initial conditions of the universe being suitable for later star formation, which of course planets could not exist, is on the order of 1 followed by 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, gravity or of the atomic weak force by even one part out of 10 to the 100th power would have prevented a life-permitting universe. Similarly, the cosmological constant which drives the early inflationary expansion of the universe must be fine-tuned to a degree of one part in 10 to the 120th power in order for the universe to be life-permitting. Roger Penrose of Oxford University has calculated that the odds of the Big Bang's initial low entropy condition obtaining by chance alone are on the order of one chance out of 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123. A number which is so incomprehensible that to call it astronomical would be a wild understatement. The inference to an intelligent designer of the cosmos seems far more rational than the atheistic hypothesis of chance. Now, some people have tried to avoid this conclusion by saying that we really shouldn't be surprised at the improbability of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life, because, after all, if the universe were not fine-tuned, then we wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. Given that we are here, we should expect the universe to be fine-tuned. But I think that the fallacy of this reasoning can be shown by means of a parallel illustration. Imagine that you were traveling abroad and were arrested on trumped-up drug charges and dragged in front of a firing squad of 100 trained marksmen, all with rifles aimed at your heart to be executed. You hear the command given, ready, aim, fire! And you hear the deafening roar of the guns. And then you observe that you're still alive, that all of the 100 marksmen missed. Now, what would you conclude? Well, I guess I should be surprised that they all missed. After all, if they hadn't all missed, I wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. Given that I am here, I should have expected them all to miss. Well, of course not. You would immediately suspect that they all missed on purpose. That the whole thing was a setup, engineered by some person for some reason. And in exactly the same way, given the incomprehensible improbability of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life, it is rational to believe that this is not the result of chance, but of design. Now, much, much more could and should be said about these matters. But I think that enough has been said to justify why I say a person is certainly within his rational rights if he believes that the universe is the product of a creator and designer of the universe. But what about belief in the Christian God? Is it rational to believe in Jesus as the Gospels portray him? Well, Jesus of Nazareth has certainly become the storm center of controversy in our day, hasn't he? As so-called members of the Jesus Seminar, radical biblical critics, have said, for example, that only 20% of the words attributed to Jesus in the Gospels are actually authentic, that is to say, actually uttered by the historical Jesus. But when you check out the evidence, a very different picture begins to emerge than the one painted by the radical critics. In fact, did you know that today the majority of New Testament critics agree that the historical Jesus deliberately stood and spoke in the place of God himself? That he claimed that in himself the kingdom of God had broken into human history, and that as visible demonstrations of this fact, he carried out a ministry of miracle working and exorcisms. According to the German theologian Horst Georg Pohlmann, and I quote, "Today there is virtually a consensus that Jesus came on the scene with an unheard of authority, with the claim of the authority to stand in God's place and speak to us and bring us to salvation. With regard to Jesus," says Pohlmann, "there are only two possible modes of behavior. Either to believe that in him God encounters us, or else nail him to the cross as a blasphemer. Tertium non datur. There is no third way." Thus, Jesus either was who he claimed to be, or else he was a blasphemous megalomaniac, which just seems implausible. But there's more. For we have dramatic historical confirmation of the validity of Jesus' radical personal claims, namely, his resurrection from the dead. Now, again, in the second half of the 20th century, there has been a dramatic reversal of scholarship with regard to this question. Back in the 30s and 40s, gospel events like the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb were widely written off as late legendary accretions that came into existence long after Jesus of Nazareth was dead and buried, and these were actually an embarrassment to the Christian faith. Similarly, the post-mortem appearances of Jesus to his disciples were explained away as hallucinations brought on by the disciples' fervent faith in Jesus. This skepticism concerning the resurrection also peaked somewhere in the late 1960s and then began very rapidly to recede. Today, it still lingers on in liberal backwaters like the Jesus Seminar. But the majority of New Testament critics today agree, number one, that after his crucifixion, Jesus' corpse was laid in a tomb by Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Jewish high court, the Sanhedrin. Two, that the tomb of Jesus was then found empty by a group of his women followers on the Sunday morning following the crucifixion. Three, that various individuals and groups of people on multiple occasions and under a variety of circumstances experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. And four, that the original disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection was not the result of their faith in him, but quite the reverse. Their faith in him was the result of their having come to believe that God had raised him from the dead. Now, those are the facts. The only question is, how do you best explain them? Well, here, the skeptical critic faces a somewhat desperate situation. For example, I had a debate a few years ago at the University of California in Irvine on the resurrection of Jesus with a professor who had written his doctoral dissertation on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. He was thoroughly familiar with the evidence, and he could not deny the facts of Jesus' burial in the tomb, of the discovery of his empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, or the origin of the disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection. And so his only recourse was to come up with some alternative explanation of those four facts. And so he argued that Jesus of Nazareth must have had an unknown identical twin brother who was separated from him at birth, grew up unbeknownst to everybody, independently of Jesus in another town, came back to Jerusalem just at the time of the crucifixion, stole Jesus' body out of the tomb, and presented himself to the disciples who mistakenly inferred that Jesus was risen from the dead. Now, I'm not going to go into how I went about refuting this theory, but let me just say that I think that the example is instructive because it shows to what desperate lengths skepticism must go in order to explain away the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, did you know that the evidence is so good that one of the world's leading Jewish theologians, the late Pinchas Lapid, who taught at Hebrew University in Tel Aviv, declared himself convinced on the basis of the evidence that the God of Israel raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. Now, again, much more could and should be said about this. But again, I think enough has been shared to show that the Christian is certainly rational in believing that Jesus rose from the dead and therefore was who he claimed to be. So, while admittedly the evidence is not enough to coerce you if your heart and mind are closed, nevertheless, I think it is certainly enough to ground faith rationally if you're just willing to look at it with an open mind and an open heart. Now, our whole discussion this evening thus far has been based upon the assumption that becoming a Christian is a matter of weighing the evidence for and against the Christian faith and then making up your mind. But when you think about it, there's surely something wrong with that assumption. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard gives the following illustration. Kierkegaard imagines a young college student who wants to decide whether or not to become a Christian, and therefore he decides to look into the evidence for Christianity. And so he begins by studying philosophy so that he can understand the philosophical arguments for and against the existence of God. He studies comparative religions so that he will understand the truth claims and worldviews of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and the other world's great religions. He studies systematic theology so that he will understand the Christian system of doctrine and its worldview. He studies Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic so that he can read the documents of the Bible in their original languages. He studies ancient history so that he can read these documents against the historical background and milieu in which they were written, and on it goes, until finally, at last, he is convinced that Christianity is true. And so, at the age of 70, he places his faith in Christ and becomes a Christian. Now, Kierkegaard regarded such a scenario as insane. Faith cannot be expected to hold its breath indefinitely while reason patiently sifts and resifts through the evidence. Or to give another illustration, imagine a native tribesman living in the jungles of Laos who hears a missionary broadcast of the gospel on the shortwave radio and senses that God is speaking to his heart and he wants to become a Christian. Isn't he rational to do so, even though he has neither the education, nor the resources, nor the leisure time to study arguments for the existence of God or explore the historical evidence for the credibility of the Gospels? Well, I want to say that he's rational in so doing. A loving God wouldn't leave it up to us to work out by our own cleverness and ingenuity whether or not he exists. Rather, a loving God would himself pursue us and seek to draw us to himself. And this is exactly what the Bible says God has done. Jesus said, "No man comes to me unless the Father who sent me draws him." And again, Jesus said, "When I am lifted up, I will draw all men to myself." So when I said earlier this evening that in order to find God, we must diligently seek him, that really wasn't the whole story. From a human perspective, I think that's true. But from God's perspective, it is really God who is seeking us. And we must decide whether or not we will open our hearts to his love and forgiveness, or whether we shut our hearts up against his grace and his love. If I might be permitted to close on a personal note, I myself wasn't raised in a Christian home or even a church-going family, though it was a good and loving home. But when I became a teenager, I began to ask what I call the big questions in life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? And in the search for answers, I began to attend all on my own a local church in our community. The only problem was that instead of answers, all I found was a sort of social country club where the dues were $1 a week in the offering plate, and the other students who pretended to be such good Christians on Sunday lived for their real God the rest of the week, which was popularity. And this really bothered me because I thought, here I am so spiritually empty inside, and yet externally I'm living a better life than they are. And they claim to be Christians. They're all just a pack of hypocrites. They must be just as empty as I am, but they're all putting up this false front, pretending to be something that they're not. And so I began to grow very bitter and resentful toward the institutional church and the people in it. And soon this attitude began to spread toward other people. Everybody, I thought, is a hypocrite. They're all phonies. Everybody is holding up a plastic mask to the world while the real person is cowering down inside, afraid to come out and be real. And so I despised people for their hypocrisy and their phoniness. I threw myself into my studies and my books in order to escape from relating to people. I said, I don't want anything to do with people. I hate people. I don't want to have any relations with them whatsoever. And I tried to escape from having to do that. But at the same time, in moments of honesty and introspection, as I looked into my own heart, I knew that deep down inside, I really did want to love and to be loved by others. And I realized in that moment that I was just as much a phony as they were. Because here I was pretending not to need or want people, when deep down inside, I knew I really did. And so that anger that I felt toward them turned in upon myself for my own phoniness and hypocrisy. And I don't know if you understand what this is like, but this kind of inner anger just eats away at your insides day after day, making every day miserable, another day to get through. And I remember one day I was feeling particularly crummy, and I walked into my high school German class, and I sat down behind a girl who's one of these types, you know, that is always so happy, it just makes you sick. And I tapped her on the shoulder, and she turned around, and I said to her, "Sandy, what are you always so happy about anyway?" And she said, "Bill, it's because I'm saved." And I said, "You're what?" And she said, "I know Jesus Christ as my personal Savior." And I said, "Well, I go to church." And she said, "That's not enough, Bill. You've got to have him really living in your heart." And I said, "Well, what would he want to do a thing like that for?" And she said, "Because he loves you, Bill." And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. Here I was so filled with anger and hate inside, and she said that there was someone who really loved me. And who was it but the God of the universe? And that thought just staggered me. To think that the God of the universe could love me, that worm named Bill Craig down there on that speck of dust called planet Earth. I just couldn't take it in. Well, I went home and I grabbed a New Testament that I had been given in the fifth grade, never opened it before. And I began to read it. And I read it from cover to cover. And as I did so, I was absolutely captivated by the person of Jesus of Nazareth. There was a ring of truth about his teaching that I had never encountered before. And there was an authenticity about this man's life that wasn't characteristic of those people who claimed to be his followers in that local church I was going to. And I realized in that moment that I couldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. As I read the New Testament, I discovered that my problem was that I was morally guilty before God for the things that I had done and said and thought, that all of us find ourselves fallen and morally culpable before God and therefore spiritually separated from Him, groping in spiritual darkness. It was no wonder that God seemed so unreal to me. Though I had been created to have a relationship with Him, that relationship had been severed by my own moral failure. But I read that God had sent His Son, Jesus Christ, into the world to die for my sin, to bear the penalty of sin that I deserve, thereby freeing up God's forgiveness and grace so that I could be born anew to a new spiritual life and a relationship with God that I was created to have. Sandy introduced me to other Christians in the high school. And I'd never met people like this. No matter what they said about Jesus, the thing that I couldn't deny was that they seemed to be in contact with a different plane of reality that I didn't even dream existed, a reality that imparted a deep meaning and peace and joy to their lives that I craved. Well, to make a long story short, I went through a period of about 6 months of the most agonizing soul-searching that I've ever been through in my life. And at the end of that time, I remember one night I simply cried out to God, and I cried out all the anger and the bitterness that was inside me. And as I did so, I felt this tremendous infusion of joy, like a balloon being blown up until it was ready to burst. I rushed outside. It was a warm September evening, and you could see the Milky Way from horizon to horizon. And as I looked up at the stars, I thought, God, I've come to know God. And that moment changed my whole life. Because, you see, I had thought enough about this message during those 6 months to realize that if this were really the truth, if it were really the truth, then I could do nothing less than give my entire life to spreading this message among mankind, because this is the greatest news ever announced. And that's basically why I'm here tonight, because I love to share this message with other persons who are searching for God and for spiritual reality in their lives. And I want to encourage you that if you're searching for God tonight and you haven't yet found Him, do what I did. Pick up the New Testament, begin to read it, and ask yourself, could this really be true? Could there really be a God who loves me, who gave His Son to die for me, that I might know Him? I believe that this is a faith that is entirely rational. In fact, that there is no other philosophy of life which stands above the Christian faith. I think that the Christian faith stands intellectually head and shoulders above any other philosophy or ism that you might care to espouse. But it meets not only the needs of my head, but also the needs of my heart. So when you're lying in bed tonight, before you go to sleep, ask yourself, could this really be true? God, if you're there, reveal yourself to me and begin to search, begin to seek. If you seek for Him with all your heart, you have His promise that you will find Him. So, arguments and evidence can help. But I think, as Pascal discovered, ultimately we have to come to grips not just with arguments, but with the living Lord Himself.
Bill, thank you very much indeed. Now, I'm sure many of you will have questions, but let me just check. How many of you think you have a comment or a question you'd like to voice publicly? Okay, first question.
About this, the fine-tuning argument that you were presenting yesterday, Mike. You were presenting it as a sort of the choice of why the universe is fine-tuned in order to be able to sustain life. You presented it as a sort of trichotomy between charges, it's chance or it's physical necessity or it's design. Now, I'd like to ask you, in that context, is there any reason to think that there might not have instead been a God who might have created a universe which couldn't sustain life? And to what factor do you attribute that to design, chance, or necessity?
Thank you very much.
This is more of a comment, really. You've been talking for 40 minutes, Dr. Craig, and I haven't felt at all sleepy. There's a compliment.
Thank you.
And yet, when I go to church sometimes, I'm I'm I can't say I'm a regular church goer, but I do go occasionally. I do find the sermons tend to go on a bit. And I was wondering if you've got any theories as to why they don't bring up some of the points which you've raised. I mean, this business about fine-tuning, I think that's marvellous. It's not that difficult, really, to understand, certainly the way you've explained it. And also the fact that some of the disciples were martyrs, they became martyrs, based very much, I suppose, on the resurrection. I mean, they must have seen something, they experienced something. I mean, to go and offer your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys were mainly fishermen, I think, weren't they? And perhaps you could offer a theory as to why don't they use this information in their sermons? Because certainly keep me awake.
I think the idea of cause and effect has been kind of proven by quantum physics has been quite anthropocentric concept, which we don't know, we can't distinguish very much between cause and effect. And it seems then it prompts that naturally the question from your talk prompts is why does the universe, the one we live in, as an exception, should be considered as intelligently designed? Isn't this a case of simple anthropomorphizing of the universe? And perhaps also the question which comes out of it is why that kind of the fashion trend within the academia that kind of falls now in favor, to some extent, towards kind of Christian thinking. Why does it validate belief as well? So, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Bill, if you'd like to take those three, and if the folks standing, they're welcome to come and perch on the front here.
All right. Let me take them in the order they were presented. First, could a God exist who couldn't sustain life? The fine-tuning argument does not lead to a God who is omniscient. It doesn't prove that God is omniscient. It only proves a God who is extraordinarily intelligent and powerful. So, theoretically, if, for example, the universe were not so finely tuned, if it were crudely tuned or something of that sort, maybe the inference would only be justified inferring an intelligent cause that was not that supremely intelligent. So I think the question is quite right. The degree of intelligence of the designer will be proportional to the complexity and delicacy of the design in the artifact. Now, let me take the other question about cause and effect not being operative in quantum physics, and therefore it's anthropomorphic or gratuitous to assume that the universe has a cause. I would like to make two responses to this claim. First of all, there are at least 10 different physical interpretations of quantum physics, which is the physics of the subatomic realm. And nobody knows which of these is correct. They all have the same mathematical core or formalism, but it is the physical interpretation of the equations that differs radically in these 10 different models. And only some of these are indeterministic, prominently the so-called Copenhagen interpretation. But others are fully deterministic. For example, in David Bohm's physical interpretation of quantum mechanics, it is fully deterministic. So it is simply not true that quantum mechanics is a counterexample or proven exception to the causal principle that everything that begins to exist has a cause. But secondly, even on the indeterministic interpretations, like the Copenhagen interpretation, it is still not the case that things come into being out of nothing. This is a gross misrepresentation in popular magazine articles and television programs where they say things like the universe is the ultimate free lunch because we got something from nothing, or that that nothingness is unstable to quantum fluctuations and so forth. What these popular writers are actually talking about is the quantum vacuum out of which particles can appear, or in some models of the universe appears in the quantum vacuum. And the vacuum is not nothing. The vacuum is a sea of fluctuating energy, which has a rich physical structure and is describable by physical laws. So it is simply not true that things that come into being indeterministically out of the vacuum come into existence without a cause or come into being out of nothing. In the case of the universe, however, We are not talking about an origination of the universe out of the quantum vacuum or out of quantum space. The quantum vacuum itself begins to exist. It has a boundary in the finite past. There is no point in space and time, say 15 billion years ago, that is pure imagination. You can think or imagine time prior to the Big Bang, but physically and ontologically or really, there isn't any such moment. So the vacuum itself comes into being out of nothing, and I think that that's evident that that must have a cause. The idea that something can come into being uncaused out of nothing is worse than magic when you think about it. It's to stop doing serious physics or metaphysics and to start appealing to magic. I mean, in magic, it's worse than magic. In magic, when the magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat, at least you've got the magician and you've got the hat. But in this case, the universe just comes into being out of absolute nothing. So it seems to me that this is metaphysically absurd, and therefore there must be a transcendent cause. Now, why aren't these issues brought up more frequently in Sunday morning sermons? I take this as a very serious question, and one with which I'm burdened. And I think that the answer is this, in my opinion. Our ministers are not adequately trained in seminary in these issues. They are trained in Christian theology, in biblical studies, but they are not adequately trained in the defense of the faith, in science, and in the interface of theology with contemporary philosophy and science. And I'm pleased to be teaching at a divinity school in the United States where the philosophy program is so important that it is the largest master's degree program in the English-speaking world in philosophy. The second behind it is the University of Toronto. And I think that our ministers badly need education and training in this sort of thinking in order to relate Christian truth claims relevantly to an increasingly secular culture in which we live. So I appreciate that question very much. And if there's anybody here who can do anything about that in terms of theological training, boy, give it your input, because I think it's sorely needed.
Okay, we'll take our next batch, if you'd like to take the mic in order.
I understand how you say that the cosmological argument is rational, but regarding stories of creationism and Adam and Eve, is that rational? And also, if it is, like, there's a lot of debate about creationism and evolution and how much effect Christianity can actually have on the state and government and education and stuff like that.
Ooh.
The God of which you speak is clearly that he got these the fine-tuning so correct. It seems to suggest that he knew we were coming from what he suggested. It implies maybe that he knew the future. And from your nodding, I'm getting some indication that you agree there. If God does know the future, where does that leave our free will? Because it's probably a question you've heard before, but where, if God does know the future, he knows which of us are going to come to him and which of us aren't. So it seems like he's almost toying with us. I'd be grateful if you could answer that.
I just noticed that you always refer to telling people that people should always, like, just, they should go away and read the New Testament. And I know that you believe in intelligent design, but what about, you know, the Old Testament and creation? Really, that's about it, I think.
Okay, take one more, shall we?
No, I think
do them in threes. So you're obviously a preacher.
Well, really
3 points.
There. Let me say, with respect to the last question, that I'm not an Old Testament scholar, and therefore I try not to speak on areas in which I am not sufficiently expert to give an opinion that I think holds up. So if you want to know about Old Testament history and things of that sort, you need to speak to someone else. I'm not expert in these Old Testament matters. I've focused my attention upon the historicity of Jesus and the Gospels. Now, let me say, however, with respect to Adam and Eve and the whole creation-evolution debate, this is an area, I think, on which Christians disagree. And I look at this as one of the non-essentials. The type of Christianity that I'm interested in defending is what C.S. Lewis called mere Christianity. That is to say, those central Christian truth claims which are common to Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox alike. And therefore, how fall out with regard to Adam and Eve, creation, evolution, for me, that's an internal debate among Christians which I have no vested stake in. I will say that it seems to me that there's nothing about the existence of a historical Adam and Eve that contradicts modern anthropology or genetics. On the contrary, the genetics show that all human beings who are alive today have descended from a single human female who lived at some point in the past. They call her the mitochondrial Eve, after the biblical narrative. Now, they're not claiming that they've actually identified Eve, but it's certainly consistent with the idea that there was an original human pair from all humankind is descended. Now, how did they arrive on the scene? Were they the products of evolution, or were they products of special creation? I think that's an open question that the Bible doesn't pronounce decisively on. The story of creation in Genesis is very, shall we say, metaphorical and symbolical. It has God, for example, walking in the garden, breathing into the nostrils of Adam the breath of life. And I don't think we're to imagine that God has a physical body or that he bent down and did CPR through Adam's nose or anything of that sort. So it could well be that this is a symbolic narrative retelling of how God created Adam and Eve through guiding the process of evolution through hominid ancestors to arrive at them. I think that's consistent. On the other hand, it's perfectly possible that the Bible means us to understand that this was a special miraculous creation of God in the case of the human pair that were the ancestors of the human race. Scientifically speaking, as I read contemporary anthropology, anthropologists themselves differ widely on how to reconstruct the tree of human evolution. Some think that certain hominid forms were actually ancestors to Homo sapiens. Others think that those same forms were not on our ancestral branch, but represent a dead end, a primate evolution that simply went extinct. And so no one really knows scientifically whether any of these hominid forms evolved into Homo sapiens. It's possible that they all represent dead ends on the tree of primate evolution and that none of them arrived in Homo sapiens. So I think that special creation would be quite consistent with the evidence, and I have no special stake in this. I am quite open to follow the evidence where it leads, and I have no strong opinions with respect to that. I will say, however, that the mechanisms that are suggested for driving the evolutionary process forward, namely random mutation, natural selection, operate so slowly that I'm very skeptical that they could have produced this degree of biological complexity in so short a relative time. In their book, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle, physicists John Barrow and Frank Tipler calculate 10 steps in the course of the evolution of Homo sapiens, such as the evolution of photosynthesis, the evolution of an endoskeleton, the evolution of mitochondria, the evolution of the human eye, and so forth. 10 steps in the course of the evolution of Homo sapiens, each of which is so improbable that before it would have taken place, the Earth, or rather the Sun, would have ceased to be a main sequence star and would have incinerated the Earth. Before any one of these steps would have occurred, the Sun would have grown from a yellow star to a red giant and annihilated the Earth before this step could have occurred. And yet all 10 allegedly took place in the course of evolution. So if we are the products of evolutionary development, it seems to me that we ought to say that this was a miracle and therefore evidence for the existence of God. Now, what about the relation between Christianity and the state or government? Here, you in this country face a very different situation than we do in my country, where we don't have an established church. We don't have a state church in the United States. And so the relationships between the church and state in England, I think, would be rather different in virtue of the fact that you have an established church here, and I'm not qualified to speak to that. But I can say this, whether the church is established or not established, I think the church has a responsibility for speaking out on governmental policies that have moral implications, so that if there are moral or ethical issues that are before legislators or before the government, the church has every right, and indeed I think the responsibility, to pronounce on these moral questions. So I'm not advocating the church get involved in politics as such, but rather on moral issues, I think the church has the responsibility to speak with a clear voice. Now, finally, what about God's foreknowledge of the future? Does this preclude free will? Well, this was a question that was of great interest to me, and in fact, I spent 7 years on this topic. As my major focus of research, I've written at least 3 books on this. Let me recommend one of them. It's called The Only Wise God. The Only Wise God. It's a study of the compatibility of divine foreknowledge and human freedom. Let me say simply this. The traditional argument for what is called theological fatalism, that is to say, that if God foreknows what you will do, then you will do it necessarily, is logically fallacious. It commits a fallacy in what's called modal logic. Modal logic is the logic of necessity and possibility. And the typical argument goes like this. Necessarily, if God foreknows X, then X will happen. God foreknows X, therefore necessarily X will happen. That argument for fatalism commits a modal fallacy. From the premises, necessarily if God foreknows X, X will happen, and God foreknows X, all that follows is X will happen. But it doesn't follow that X will happen necessarily. X will happen, but it will happen contingently. And if it were to fail to happen, then God would have foreknown otherwise. Another way of thinking about it is that God's knowledge is chronologically prior to the event, but the event is logically prior to God's foreknowledge. God's foreknowledge is like an infallible barometer of the weather. If you had an infallible barometer of the weather, you would always know infallibly what the weather will be tomorrow. But does the barometer determine the weather? No, not at all. It's the weather that determines the barometer. Now, if the weather were to be different, then the barometer would read differently. And God's foreknowledge in that way tracks what your choices in the future will be. You have complete freedom to choose A or not A, and God's knowledge will simply infallibly track that. So that your decision is logically prior to what God foreknows, even though what God foreknows is chronologically prior to your choice. And therefore, I think there's no incompatibility between divine foreknowledge and human freedom.
Okay, we'll take another batch of three. If anyone thinks that a question hasn't been fully answered, do feel free to prompt the person who asked it to come back for second helpings or help that person out by asking on their behalf. We'll take 3 more, and then we may do something different after that.
I just wanted to say that I have always had an extreme fear of death, and this has therefore prompted me to try to understand, if at all possible, what might happen after death. And I've obviously come to the conclusion that either I will perish or else I will live, I will survive, either without, in a world without end in some way, or else I will go on to another phase of existence which itself ends. And my problem is that I cannot decide what, not only can I not decide what is true, but I also can't decide what exactly I would like to happen. And this is a quite awful feeling. So obviously it would be very much in my interest if I were to accept and embrace Christianity, because I would then quite clearly have peace of mind. So I ask myself, why is it that I can't do that? Have I turned away from God? And I say to myself that I haven't. But at the same time, I cannot honestly tell my Christian friends that I am a Christian believer. And so I'm in a very difficult situation. I mean, I sort of feel I'm either with God or I'm not with God. But I would disagree that I've actually turned my back on God. I haven't been aware that God has, as it were, knocked on my door and that I've turned him away. And yet at the same time, that I can't feel that I've actually accepted God. And of course I obviously, however I go about it, because of my extreme fear of death, it's very, very much in my interest that I do arrive at, shall we say, a belief, not just a belief, that it's almost as if I really must know what happens, that nothing less than the truth will do.
Thank you very much.
quite a lot of these ideas are very academic and require a lot of brain power. So how can I or other people tone down these arguments? Or what other arguments and proofs are there so that younger people can be reached out to instead of lots of long words? And how can I reach out to my friends using the same arguments but make them understandable?
I've got a couple of questions. One is about, would you recommend reading The God Delusion if you have? I have a boyfriend and a neighbour who strongly recommend I should read this, and I'm a Christian, and I don't really want to. I'm a bit scared about it. And also, have you ever thought about having a debate with Richard Dawkins?
With respect to the last question, Peter May, who organized the tour, wrote a very nice letter to Richard Dawkins, inviting him to debate me in Central Hall in London. He explained that William Craig was a philosopher of science, interested in religious subjects, and would love to engage in a debate on, is God a delusion? And Peter showed me the letter that Richard Dawkins wrote back to him. He said, I wouldn't debate a religious person unless he were at least a bishop. And since Craig isn't a bishop, he doesn't qualify that. Moreover, I have never heard of William Lane Craig. And while a debate with him might look good on his resume, it would not look good on mine. So we have not managed to pull that one off. But I would not recommend reading The God Delusion. And the reason why is because it is so filled with misinformation that you would need to know your way around very well in Old Testament studies, New Testament studies, biology, physics, philosophy, and many, many other fields in order to discern all the mistakes. And I just fear that a person who isn't sufficiently well-read in this broad range of material would be just basically overwhelmed by the sort of barrage of misinformation that is in the book. So for that reason, I don't recommend reading it. Now, how can we make these arguments simpler? Let me say, first of all, if I may, these arguments, as I presented them tonight, were enormously simplified. I mean, I hope that nobody thinks that this was a scholarly presentation this evening. I tried to use illustrations to make my points clear. This was really toned down. I mean, if you were to go to a philosophy conference or a science conference, you would be just blown away by the depth of the discussion of these kinds of issues as academics handle them. So this is actually very, very simplified already. But if you want to make them even simpler, I suppose what I might recommend would be Lee Strobel's books, The Case for Christ and The Case for a Creator. Lee interviewed me for both of those books, as well as many other fine scholars, and then he wrote these up on a very simple lay level. And if you want it even simpler than that, I understand that Lee has a version of The Case for Christ, at least, that is out in a student edition for high schoolers, that is rewritten in more contemporary slang and is very simple. But beware, I mean, you the danger is you become simplistic rather than simple. We want to make it simple without being simplistic. And so if you found it difficult, maybe look at Lee Strobel's books, Case for Christ, Case for the Creator. But then once you've graduated from those, so to speak, go to something at a more intermediate level like Reasonable Faith or certain other books and begin to grow more in this area. Now, with respect to the first gentleman's question, which I deeply appreciated for its honesty, I think you're entirely right to have an extreme fear of death. I think that death is enormously threatening. The theologian Paul Tillich called this the threat of non-being. The idea that I shall cease to exist, that I, the person who seems so real, so present, will cease to be, that I will be no more, is, I think, rightly regarded as enormously threatening, that I should cease to exist. And if that is what death is, namely personal annihilation, it puts a question mark, I think, behind all of life. What is the meaning of life if that is life's end? What does it matter how you live if you all end up the same? What purpose ultimately is there to living if it just ends in annihilation? If death means personal annihilation, and that is the end, and that is all there is, then all the petty projects and purposes that we fill our lives with are just so much meaningless activity. It's like shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic. There is no significance to it. So I think you're quite right to feel keenly this threat of non-being and fear of death. And I also appreciate deeply what you say when you say, not only do I not know which is true, whether I'll be annihilated or continue to live on, but I'm not sure which I prefer. Because while I think immortality is a necessary condition for life to be meaningful, valuable, and purposeful, immortality alone is not sufficient. It's a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition. To illustrate, I heard or read a science fiction story once where of an astronaut who was marooned on a barren asteroid in outer space with no hope of rescue. And he had with him two vials. One contained a suicide potion that would kill him. The other contained a potion for immortality. And realizing his predicament that he would never be rescued, that he was marooned forever, he gulped down the vial containing the poison. And then, to his horror, he realized he had swallowed the wrong vial. He had drunk the potion for immortality, and thus he was cursed to exist forever, a meaningless, purposeless, pointless life. And this would indeed be like hell. Mere immortality is not enough to invest life with meaning and significance. In addition to immortality, the other necessary condition is God. I think it is God and immortality that are the two necessary and sufficient conditions for life to be significant and meaningful and valuable and purposeful. The purpose for which we were made is to know God, the infinite source of goodness and love. And this is something that can satisfy us for infinity. No finite good could satisfy us for infinity into the future. Even Shakespeare, even Mozart would grow cloying and boring after enough time. Only an infinite good can satisfy man's insatiable thirst for eternity. And God is such an inexhaustible good, infinite goodness and love. And so it is immortal, personal relationship and fellowship with God forever that I think the fulfillment of human existence is to be found. It is, as Kierkegaard said, what we were made for. It is the meaning and fulfillment of human existence. Now, that's what we should prefer. How do we decide? Well, I think that here the resurrection of Jesus is the key. Jesus of Nazareth is the only person who has come back through the door to death from the other side and tells us that through belief in him, we will live forever in relation to God. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And he who lives and believes in me shall never die. So it is the promise of the resurrection, I think, that gives us hope for a meaningful, purposeful, immortal existence. And so it is on the basis of the evidence for the resurrection that I've sketched tonight that I think we can have confidence that personal immortality is true. But what can you do if you cannot believe in this, if you find you cannot believe, even though you're not resisting God? I think you find yourself in a similar situation to what I was in during those 6 months. During those 6 months of searching, trying to find God, it wasn't that I was resistant or that I didn't believe. I think my beliefs were intellectually in the right place, but somehow I just couldn't connect with him. And I would simply encourage you to keep searching, to keep seeking, to pray, to read the Bible, to ask God to reveal himself to you, to seek after him. I would encourage you to go to worship services where meaningful biblical worship is carried on. I would encourage you to find some sort of a Christian partner, some person who knows Christ and walks with him, who would partner with you to take you on this journey. And I believe that if you will go on this sort of spiritual search in an earnest way, that you have the promise of God that he will meet with you. The Bible says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. And I found that we can trust him and keep him at his word.